This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll check in with San Luis Obispo County Public Health Director Penny Borenstein.
It's so important to get past this pandemic quickly so that we don't give the virus more opportunities to create mutations that are even more discerning in terms of vaccine efficacy.
Also, we'll take a look at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival.
And I think we all cried for 24 hours. We just thought we were going to go just online. And then 24 hours later, this other dream of doing drive-ins at City College materialized.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 5th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. A new art exhibit documenting the local Black Lives Matter movement is open for virtual viewing. It showcases the thousands who marched in San Luis Obispo for months in 2020. They're calling for racial justice as part of the national outcry over the killings by police of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. KCBX's Michael Barros has more.
Breonna Taylor! Breonna Taylor!
The installation at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art is titled We All Bleed. It includes black and white photographs of the 2020 marches taken by Richard Fasillo. Alongside his photos are audio clips of local black activists talking about their experiences.
How important it is that small communities like San Luis Obispo County and the city, how important activism is and can be, and how it could actually affect where we live.
Fasillo says his intention is to highlight both the joyous and tense moments throughout the marches, partly by including protest signs that cover a full wall of the exhibit.
I mean, we had like 100 signs, which was really awesome. It was really fun to put together on the wall. It was kind of like a giant Tetris piece.
Joshua Anthony Powell, also known as JP, is a contributor to the art installation and is one of the people in the photographs. During the height of the marches, Powell says many people were pushing an incorrect narrative that the protests were destructive and violent.
These marches, this movement that happened was beautiful, and it brought people together, and it allowed folks a space to feel free.
It's been slightly over a year since police killed Breonna Taylor. And Powell, who uses they-them pronouns, says they hope Taylor's loss is not forgotten, and that the art exhibit will serve as historical documentation of the continuous fight for racial justice following her death.
Can you fathom that? Can you fathom just sleeping, feeling as if everything's okay, you have your partner next to you, holding you safe and tight, all of a sudden, your door gets busted down, 32 rounds of bullets get blown all throughout your apartment, and you are the only casualty there.
Nala Lohman is a SLO County resident featured in the exhibit. She says she's happy to see black representation in San Luis Obispo in a way she hasn't before.
There are people out there who are going to uplift us the way Richard has. And so it's okay for us to keep going out and making, you know, the white community uncomfortable because we just want to fight for our liberation. Having such a symbolic art installment by Richard put in downtown SLO, that was huge for us.
Lohman says over time, as the protests got smaller due to the worsening pandemic, mutual aid efforts increased that included community efforts to redistribute money, food, and needed resources to residents who need them.
So it's a lot of like little things like that that people don't see as a part of activism. They think that, you know, the only thing we do is post on Instagram and show up for protests. But a lot of us, it's a lot of Zoom meetings. It's a lot of preparation. It's a lot of talking with officials.
Lohman encourages her peers to keep moving forward with the activism that started during these protests.
With all of that, just continue to fight day in and day out wherever you are, you know, whether it's in your family, whether it's within your friend group, or if it's physically within your community.
The exhibit We All Bleed, documenting the perspectives of black activists in the Black Lives Matter movement in San Luis Obispo, are on display at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art and also can be viewed virtually on the SLOMA website. The installation will be up through May 2nd, and the exhibit also features a film by civil rights photographer Danny Lyon titled SNCC, hosted in partnership with Race Matters SLO. The film will premiere both in person and virtually, with a conversation between Lyon and local activists following the showing. Tickets will go on sale April 10th, when guests can also sign up for a timed viewing of the gallery. For KCBX News, I'm Michael Barros.
This KCBX Arts Beat story was made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Not far from the UC Santa Cruz campus is a 40-acre forest plot. Students have been counting seeds and measuring trees on this plot for more than a decade. That data has been used in a new study that aims to understand what our forest will look like in generations to come. And the findings suggest that change is on the horizon. KAZU's Michelle Loxton has more.
A short walk away from the roadway and into the UCSC Campus Natural Reserve, along a slim and recently rain-soaked dirt path, passing redwoods, Douglas firs, and Pacific madrones, Gregory Gilbert finds what he's been looking for, a seed trap.
There's some really cool fruits in here.
The trap looks like an elevated netted basket that's been collecting a whole lot of debris that's fallen from the trees above. The UCSC Environmental Studies professor rummages through what's in the trap. He's excited by what's been collected.
There's probably several dozen redwood seeds in here, and there's one cone of a Douglas fir that fell, and so it's got a bunch of seeds inside it, and there's one fruit, one seed of a hazelnut, of a California hazelnut. I hardly ever get to see them because the squirrels all come and eat them before I ever find them.
These traps are scattered throughout a 40-acre plot called the FERP, or Forest Ecology Research Plot. The FERP is part of the larger reserve. And every 2 weeks since 2008, students have recorded every seed, leaf, and fruit that's landed in the traps. Students like Ishana Shukla.
I have been out here, I think, more times than I can count. The FERP kind of feels like a second home to me.
Shukla is studying ecology and evolutionary biology.
It's very, very detailed work, so you have to make sure you're being precise when you're counting seeds. Or if you're measuring a tree, you have to make sure you're getting the millimeters extremely correct.
And it's thanks to long-term data collection like this in monitoring sites across North America that scientists have been able to determine that climate change is causing declines in seed production for older and larger trees in western forests. Professor Gregory Gilbert again.
The amount of seeds that our trees are producing are sort of hitting a kind of plateau right here. So for right now, it's fine. But as trees eventually die through diseases, through pests, through fires, through lightning strikes, the species that are going to replace that are going to depend on what seeds are available.
Meaning, over long periods of time, we're talking generations, West Coast forests could look different. These changes could mean the loss of regional flora and diversity in our forests. Gilbert is a co-author of this new study, along with UCSC Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies, Kai Zhu.
Over generations, this will not happen immediately, but over generations, we are likely to see few smaller individuals that are replacing large individuals.
Zhu says a study like this is so important because it addresses what he feels has been missing from the study of how climate change is affecting trees, the beginning of a tree's life.
So without the reproduction piece, our understanding will be incomplete, and that will sort of decrease our ability to anticipate the change in the future.
And that's where forest management comes in. If foresters can predict what future forests may look like, they could have the option to adapt. As we prepare to leave the forest, Gregory Gilbert reflects on the changes that are already very much apparent.
If we look around, you can see, I can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, at least 11 madrones that I can see here that have all died in the last 5 years.
Gilbert calls these trees awesome, with their peeling bark and red coloring, growing at strange angles.
Who's going to replace it? Is it going to be other madrones and other tan oaks, or is it going to be completely taken over by Douglas fir or some other species that comes in?
What is likely is that the forests of the future will look different from the forests of today.
That was KAZU's Michelle Loxton reporting. Take a walk around Santa Maria and you'll notice a public art boom, including brightly painted utility boxes and murals celebrating the town's culture and heritage. Funding is a challenge, but local artists and advocates are working together to bring new art to public spaces. KCBX's Beth Thornton has the story.
Dennis Smitherman, who oversees public art for the Santa Maria Department of Recreation and Parks, says art is on the rise in the city. He is currently coordinating the Utility Box Art Project, which features the work of local artists who paint the city's utility boxes with themes of Santa Maria. Now beginning its third phase, phases one and two of the project have produced boxes featuring strawberries, wildflowers, dancers, wine, and more. Smitherman says the citywide project is a way to bring colorful, culturally relevant artwork to otherwise bland street corners. Local artists submit their designs for consideration, and if chosen, receive a stipend and reimbursement for expenses. Ruben Espinoza's artwork has been selected twice.
The first one I submitted was a charro and a bull. That was kind of playing to my culture and also like the heritage of Santa Maria, which was a Western town.
Espinoza also paints murals. He spent almost 4 days painting the Welcome to Santa Maria mural at East El Camino and North Broadway. The mural, on the side of a business, features vintage lettering in English and Spanish.
I wanted to do something that was, you know, welcoming to people that were visiting and also, you know, beautifying their neighborhood and their building.
Espinoza painted the welcome mural for free. He says a fund for public art would make more projects like this possible.
Some sort of public funding, more businesses would be involved in funding these projects, because ultimately I think public art does benefit a lot of the businesses around.
Santa Maria adopted a public art plan in 2019, but not a Percent for Art fund to pay for it. Percent for Art funds are a common way for cities to support the arts. The city of San Luis Obispo has one. Funds are generated through a fee, often less than 1%, on capital construction project budgets. Without a specific fund, the city and its local art community must rely on other sources of support, such as private donations and grants. Santa Maria's Corazon del Pueblo, a nonprofit center for arts and culture, is also bringing art to outdoor spaces. They mentor youth and offer classes, including mural painting. Alex Espinoza Kulik is the center's executive director. He says they have received grants from the County of Santa Barbara, as well as generous donations to support their work, and they partner with other organizations.
The new mural will be a collaboration between the Boys and Girls Club, our organization, and young people we work with through Chicano Renaissance, as well as the Youth Arts Alive program.
Espinoza Kulik says the mural project creates an opportunity for meaningful conversation.
A mural will be an opportunity not just to create public art, but for young people to really come together and have a facilitated conversation through the arts about how they see themselves in their community and the aspects of history and culture that influence their day-to-day lives.
Corazon del Pueblo began as a place to gather for art and conversation to address youth violence, according to the center's co-founder, Alma Hernandez.
Art is a way for, you know, the community to be able to share ideas, to be able to create an understanding of one another.
The Santa Barbara County Office of Arts and Culture makes grants to support projects of all types throughout the county. Executive Director Sarah York Rubin says public art plays an important role in communities.
It can be a deep community celebration of identity. It can also be a reason for visitors to come to a space to experience it differently.
Santa Maria has a map on the city website to help you locate city-sponsored public art. As for murals at schools or on the sides of local businesses, you can discover those as you walk through town. If you want to join this growing art movement, Santa Maria Rec Department's Committee for Public Art needs volunteers, as does Corazon del Pueblo. Corazon President Samuel Duarte says they are always looking to collaborate with other organizations and always in search of new walls to paint. For the KCBX Arts Beat, I'm Beth Thornton.
This KCBX Arts Beat story was made possible by a grant from the Shanbrom Family Foundation. On March 27th, around 300 Santa Barbara community members gathered in solidarity with the Asian Pacific Islander community. We'll have a report coming up. First, KCSB's Yelena Teagle provides some background.
The recent events of anti-Asian sentiment and Asian American violence, from verbal and online harassment to physical assault, have been occurring at increasing rates during the COVID-19 pandemic. However, such events are unfortunately built upon a history of xenophobia and misogyny through treacherous events of hatred towards Asian Americans here in the United States. Earlier atrocities against people of Asian descent in the U.S. can be dated back as early as the Chinese Massacre of 1871, in which a mob in Los Angeles, Chinatown, attacked and murdered 19 Chinese residents. Shortly after, the Page Act of 1875 placed a ban on only female East Asian immigrants to the U.S. This act is seen as an early effort to restrict Asian immigration on the basis of race that was later reinforced 7 years later. In 1882, President Chester A. Arthur signed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which banned the immigration of all Chinese laborers into the United States. As postdoctoral fellow in the Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History, Courtney Sato mentions, quote, "that far back, we can see how racism and sexism were being conflated," end quote. And xenophobia was essentially justified by the law. Perhaps the most famous era of anti-Asian American sentiment occurred during World War II, as Asian Americans were scapegoated during this period of national duress. As a response to the attack on Pearl Harbor, about 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast were labeled as a potential enemy threat and were forced into internment camps under President Franklin Roosevelt through Executive Order 9066. Military zones were created in the states with a large population of Japanese Americans, such as in California, Washington, and Oregon. As of March of 1942, the executive order called for the forced evacuation and detention of West Coast residents of Japanese descent on a 48-hour notice. To further enforce this executive order, Congress had also passed Public Law 503 only a few days before the proclamation, which made violation of Executive Order 9066 a misdemeanor punishable by up to 1 year in prison and a $5,000 fine. Anyone who was at least 1/16th Japanese was evacuated, which included 17,000 children under the age of 10, and nearly 70,000 of the evacuees were American citizens, all of which had no valid charges of disloyalty. As a result, many families lost their homes, farms, businesses, and most of their private belongings. Following the Supreme Court decision of the case Endo versus the United States, which challenged the constitutionality of the relocation and curfew orders, the internment camps began to close in 1945. However, to give Roosevelt the chance to begin camp closures before the announcement of their decision, the Supreme Court made their settlement 2 years after the case was initially presented in court and only 1 day after Roosevelt began camp closures. Finally, in 1976, President Gerald Ford officially repealed Executive Order 9066, and in 1988, nearly 50 years after the commencement of Executive Order 9066, Congress issued a formal apology and passed the Civil Liberties Act. According to Renee Tajima Pena, a professor of Asian American Studies at UCLA, anti-Asian hostility and violence spikes in times of national crisis, whether it be during World War II in the 1940s or the global pandemic today. On March 16, 2021, exactly 1 year after Trump's first Chinese virus tweet that arguably sparked the recent anti-Asian sentiment, the mass shooting in Atlanta that resulted in the deaths of 8 individuals, 6 of which were Asian women, became yet another atrocity against individuals of Asian descent. In fact, Stop AAPI Hate, a coalition that tracks incidents of violence and harassment against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in the U.S., reported close to 3,800 instances, though the number could be much higher, of discrimination against Asians within the past year, most of which were against women. For now, several nonprofit groups like Stop AAPI Hate are combating these unfortunately prolonged injustices in the United States. I'm Yelena Teagle.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX, listener-supported public radio. Next, we'll hear from contributor Ashley Rush.
On Saturday, March 27th, nearly 300 members of the Santa Barbara community gathered in solidarity with the Asian American Pacific Islander community on the corner of Anapamu and State Street to honor the lives of those killed in the March 16th Atlanta shooting, which left 8 dead, including 6 women of Asian descent. Organizers and participants also gathered to recognize over 3,800 acts of anti-Asian violence across the U.S. in the past year, equating to a 150% increase in these hate crimes since the onset of the pandemic. The vigil was part of a nationwide day of action to condemn anti-Asian violence, in which demonstrators gathered in cities across the U.S. to show their solidarity with the AAPI community in this moment of mourning and mobilize for change. At Santa Barbara's vigil, generations of community members, both Asian Americans and allies of other racial backgrounds, held signs in solidarity that read, quote, "Hate is the virus, love is the cure," and "Stop Asian hate," among other supportive messages. Attendees gathered around 1 p.m. and stayed for roughly 1 hour, following coronavirus safety guidelines by socially distancing and wearing masks. The majority of attendees wore white, the color of mourning in many Asian cultures. The vigil was organized by local residents Karina Ju, Sharon Hashida, Juliette Velarde Batita, and Judy Guillermo Newton. The vigil did not consist of speeches and rallying cries. Rather, it was an overwhelmingly solemn and peaceful event in remembrance of the lives who were lost, alongside a brief ceremonial performance. After the vigil, I spoke with organizer Juliette Velarde Batita about the process of helping organize the event.
And you were one of the organizers
for
the vigil?
Yeah, there was today? Four of us that decided we should do something for the community. Mm-hmm. I have a book club, all Asian women, and them said, so what do we do? And I said, oh, we should stage a vigil so that we could at least honor originally the 6 women that died in Georgia. There's Judy Guillermo Newton, Sharon Ushida, who's our voice, Karina Ju, and I. So we got together a week ago and then tried to put it together as fast as we could so we don't have to lose the momentum.
Juliette also spoke about her own experience and identity as an Asian American woman and long-term resident of Santa Barbara, a community with a 3.9% Asian population.
One of the things I know about myself in this community is how invisible we have been. There have been lots of political rallies, and we are never asked to speak to them. So that always bothers me, because we do have people who are very strong political activists who have great wisdoms to share, but we're not as visible as a coalition or as a community. So that's what we are trying to do here today.
And then just a final question, where do you hope, with all this momentum and coalition, where do you hope we go from here?
We hope to create a directory of all the Asian businesses in this town, Asian-owned, so that we can promote us as a community.
Among attendees was also Santa Barbara Public Health Director, Dr. Vonda Reynoso, who has gained countywide recognition for her efforts keeping the community informed about the coronavirus pandemic. During March 19th's virtual press conference, Do Reynoso condemned the Atlanta shooting and recent uptick in anti-Asian violence.
I'd like to take this opportunity to honor the lives lost in the recent Atlanta shooting spree. It is critical for us to note that of the 8 people who lost their lives, 6 were Asian women. As public health director and as an Asian American woman, I'm devastated by the senseless loss of lives. This killing spree and other attacks on members of the Asian American Pacific Islander community threatened the health and safety of all members of our community. Collectively, we must recognize that racism, individual, institutional, and systemic, is truly a public health crisis. So I invite you to take action. Speak up when you witness racism and bias in action or speech. Listen and create safe space for the community member who's being targeted. Engage in discussions on equity in race, gender, sexual preference, and all aspects of life. Support the collection of data and other robust measures of accountability in order to track and assess progress on achieving racial equity. Prioritize investment in promoting racial and economic equity to address social determinants of health. Support proclamation that racism is a public health crisis. I'd like to thank Supervisor Greg Hart, who will be co-sponsoring this proclamation at an upcoming Board of Supervisor meeting. The Public Health Department will continue to work in partnership with all of you to develop strategies to address and dismantle racism and bias that's fueling these attacks and other hate crimes so that we can build a more just, equitable, and healthy county for all.
According to the organization Stop AAPI Hate, 3,795 incidents of hate crimes against the AAPI community were reported from March 19, 2020 to February 28, 2021. But as pointed out by Asian American lawmakers like Representative Judy Chu of California, reported hate crimes are just the tip of the iceberg, as there remains a severe underreporting of hate crimes within the Asian American community due to fear. To report a hate incident, go to stopaapihate.org. With KCSB News, I'm Ashley Rush.
That was KCSB's Yelena Teagle and Ashley Rush reporting from Santa Barbara through a partnership with KCBX. San Luis Obispo County Public Health Director Penny Borenstein recently answered some questions about COVID-19. KCBX's Tom Wilmer has the story.
Where did you go to med school?
Medical school was in Syracuse, New York. It was the State University of New York Upstate Medical Center.
Did you have a clue that you were going to be public health when you got out?
Yeah, I actually did. As a very unusual medical student, I went to med school with the notion that I wanted to do public health when I got out. That was very untraditional of my peers.
Yeah. What attracted you?
I think I've always had a global sense and a service commitment, and serving populations to me was something that was very attractive. I did practice pediatrics for a number of years. I love children. I love providing that one-on-one. But I went and got my master's in public health after medical school and knew that I just wanted to take a larger approach to the community's health.
Did you do any overseas time?
I have dabbled in international health. Yes, I was the first medical student in my class who developed an elective rotation in my fourth year. I went to the Philippines and spent a couple of months there doing rural health. I spent a summer in Colombia doing family planning work, and I also got to spend a month in Kenya doing international work. I did spend 3 months in India doing polio eradication.
Wow. So all that history and background, the COVID probably was not as much a surprise to you as it would have been to a lot of people, right?
Yeah, so for a very long time, if we go back to about 20 years when bird flu was coming on the scene and lots of concerns about the mix of viruses or other types of organisms.
Was
between
it SARS?
No, was actually, let me try to remember, H1N5, the avian flu, bird flu, where there was cross communication between chickens and other poultry and human beings getting sick with this novel type of influenza all through, the late 1990s, early 2000s. And SARS and, we for a long time, Zika understood that organisms, viruses, mostly parasites that can live in other species, be it insects, bats, mammals, etc., we as humans are in connection with those and very much at risk for having a human variation of these organisms that sometimes often don't create a problem in their host. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they do. Lots of pigs die from flu, etc. But certainly I understood that we were always at risk for this kind of event. Right. I always hoped it wouldn't happen, mm-hmm. But you knew it's not a shock.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want to get stuck on this one, but I have to ask. Right now, as you know, World Health and whatnot, they're in China trying to deconstruct the roots of the virus and where it started. And you have laboratory and you have wet market. And just bottom line, what would be your gut instinct?
I am aware that it is important to go back and try to determine from whence a new organism gets into the human species. Yeah, laboratory is one thing that's being looked at. But, you know, most of these novel pathogens that come to humans come directly from our contact with animals. So be it a wet market, a farm, zoos occasionally, it is direct communicability from animals to human hosts often.
So let's jump forward. Mm-hmm. It's been approximately a year since the COVID took off and went crazy. Now, in some respects, it's settling down, but now you have the rise of these variants, the UK and the South Africa and whatnot. Talk to us about your thoughts on that, on the variants, and how that is going to be a possible game changer for us going forward.
Yeah, I think that people understandably are very frustrated by the changes that have ensued with this disease. I hear very often from frustrated members of the public that they keep moving the goalposts, the rules of the game keep changing. What that relates to is that we humans have a lot to learn from these bugs. And in this case, many things that we thought were true early on have changed. At the very beginning, I remember being up at a microphone many times saying, you don't have to worry about asymptomatic spread. You know, if someone's not sick, then they're not going to transmit the disease. Wrong. We said children don't get the disease in great numbers. Wrong. So many things, as any new disease takes hold in a community, in a world, we are constantly learning from gathering data, from looking at the science, from developing a new understanding of how this pathogen changes. So one more case of being wrong was coronaviruses, which most commonly cause the common cold. The narrative was they don't mutate very much, very stable virus, as opposed to, let's say, influenza or the flu virus. Why we get a flu vaccine every year is because that virus changes its stripes every year. So basically, a flu vaccine is developed every year by looking at what the circulating variants are in the southern hemisphere. And we're seeing the same thing now with coronavirus, with this SARS-CoV-2, that in fact it does mutate, mm-hmm. not quite at the same pace or not as significantly as other types of viruses, particularly flu, but it's changing enough that it's causing great concern.
But it's a random variant in that you can't predict in which direction it's going to go, correct?
That is true. And why it's so important to pay attention is not just because we want to make sure that the vaccines that we've developed continue to be effective, the treatments continue to be effective, is because the more you allow spread of this disease, the more opportunities this virus has to change. Mm-hmm. So we're worried about these variants today, but why it's so important to get past this pandemic quickly is so that we don't give the virus more opportunities to create even further mutations, and maybe mutations that are, you know, even more discerning in terms of vaccine efficacy.
Talk to us for just a moment about herd immunity and your thoughts about that.
So herd immunity is defined by the percentage of the population who are protected from getting sick from a particular organism, virus in this case, so that the virus really has nowhere to turn to get its next victim.
It just gives up and goes away?
Yeah, it basically, it can be either eliminated or go underground until there's a new population of susceptible people. Mm-hmm. So with measles, for instance, you have to get upwards of 90% of the population either immune by having had the disease or having had the vaccine in order for that very, very easily spread virus to not be able to find any new susceptible hosts. Mm-hmm. With COVID, you know, the hope is it will be somewhat less, 80-85%. If we can get to that place where we've got that much vaccine coverage, mm-hmm. that the opportunity for this virus to continue to spread, to find new people that it can infect, will prevent it from taking hold.
Okay, prognosis, let's look forward in time, best hope scenarios.
If we all keep doing the things that public health experts and myself have been recommending, which is stay patient, stay protective by wearing masks, by keeping your distance, by not gathering in large groups, you know, especially without facial coverings, and we can keep the number of new cases down so that we have the opportunity to avoid further mutations and we get the vaccine into 80% of arms, we can do that in a few months.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Contributor Tom Wilmer is speaking with San Luis Obispo County Public Health Director Penny Borenstein.
Let's travel forward 6 months and assuming an 80 to 90% rate of inoculation. What does the county look like? What does a restaurant look like? What is a theater, music venues? What do you envision best case?
With 80 to 90% of people vaccinated and without mutations having taken hold, we can get back to normal.
So you could see a public gathering with lots of people fairly close, yeah, without wearing a mask?
I do. I mm-hmm. think that is within our sights. Mm-hmm. We just have to move from where we are today to that point carefully, mm-hmm. and with lots of people agreeing to take this very safe and effective vaccine.
So that is the one simple variable in this scenario, right?
Yes. And between now and then, people have to remain patient about continuing to be cautious, continuing to move in their communities in the ways that are necessary, which means not gathering at this moment in time, continuing to wear masks.
Okay. So that being said, you have had both your shots, correct?
I have.
I have too, as of yesterday. So now, how does that dynamic change between you and me in a personal face-to-face meeting?
So at this point, in order to be clear about understanding the situations in which it's okay to take the mask off, it really is only in private settings. Mm-hmm. So
if you and I walk downtown San Luis Obispo, we would both be advised to wear a mask?
I would still wear a mask, as I do, in public with mm-hmm. people that I don't know, if there's one person around or there's 10 people around, because I don't know who's vaccinated, and mm-hmm. we're not going to, you know, imprint that on people's foreheads. So the assumption is, in public settings where you don't know everyone's status or everyone who's around you, that we continue to wear masks. Mm-hmm. You know, I would ask of everyone in the community that we just create a circle of protection.
So even though I've had both my shots, as I go out, can I still be a transmitter?
So when we first started getting some data back from early vaccination trials, the thought was that even though you might not get sick with the disease, that you might have enough virus to actually transmit it to someone even after vaccination. More recent data is showing, now that we've got, you know, 3+ months under our belt with this vaccine and millions of people being vaccinated, that not only will you not get sick, it is very unlikely that someone who's been fully vaccinated can transmit the disease, will have enough virus in their system to spread it to others. That said, so while it might be safe for you to walk around downtown and know that you're not transmitting to others, again, it is sort of setting the tone for our population, half, well, more than half, who are not yet vaccinated, that we not have the cans and the cannots until we really all have the opportunity to be vaccinated. And that's coming very soon.
So it's been a year. How has your world changed? How has your view of your job and going forward, what have you learned that you would apply?
I know. Taking a big pause.
Yeah.
So I think, I know this perhaps sounds cliche, but it is true. Humility is probably the number one most important aspect of a job like this, is being able to be honest with your public, with yourself, about what you know and what you don't know. And to ask of the public to understand that we're learning all the time, including the subject matter experts, including physicians, and then applying all of that newfound knowledge to the situation at hand. I have learned, I would not say learned actually, it is probably not new, but absolutely emphasized that we are very different people across the spectrum, and it is exceedingly difficult to operate with a common mindset. So I have really taken the approach of trying to bring people toward the middle, because I think in the end of the day, extremism in any either direction is not helpful for us achieving a community, a population-based approach to solving the issue at hand, this pandemic. And I have done so with an eye toward understanding that there is more to life than preventing COVID. So all of the decisions that we've made locally, which have been largely imposed by the federal or state government in terms of our operations, business and guidances and rules and executive orders, but within that framework have really worked hard at partnership across all sectors of our community, the school sector, the faith-based sector, business communities, you know, non-English speaking populations, et cetera, to really try and communicate and find common ground.
Penny, if somebody wanted to learn more about the world of COVID we've been talking about, questions, et cetera, where do you direct them?
So in terms of high-level scientific information, I really think that cdc.gov is your best, most comprehensive source of information about the disease, COVID-19. Anyone who wants to understand what the rules of the road are in our county, where you can get vaccine, where you can get tested, what we are doing locally, what's going on in your community, readyslow.org is your best source. And my name is Penny Borenstein. I'm the county health officer and public health director for the County of San Luis Obispo.
Thank you. And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting.
For local information on COVID-19 in Monterey County, go to co.monterey.ca.us. And in Santa Barbara County, check readysbc.org. And finally, the 36th annual Santa Barbara International Film Festival runs through this Saturday, April 10th. KCSB's Harry Lawton reports.
While scaled back some, the festival will still provide, as always, an exciting window into the state of world cinema and a showcase of international talent. Downtown theaters are still closed. The major events, above all the award ceremonies, will be online, which is where the movies will be available as well. Nevertheless, a fair proportion of the films on offer this year will be seen on actual screens, courtesy of City College, which will be converting two parking lots down by Cabrillo Boulevard into drive-in cinemas. I talked with Roger Durling, artistic director of the festival, and two of his senior programmers, Audrey Arn and Mickey Dusdovich. The festival will give its Lifetime Achievement Award to Bill Murray. Mickey Dusdovich was particularly delighted by this choice.
Well, I was super excited to find out that we were honoring Bill. With Ghostbusters, he ended up actually stealing the show. He ended up taking lines from people because he was so funny.
Murray, of course, is not just a simple clown. Roger Durling agrees.
That melancholy in Lost in Translation, where there's this sense of ennui in the character. I'm using big words. I mean, think also his work in Wes Anderson films, The Life Aquatic, The Royal Tenenbaums. He was known as a clown, but he's a terrific actor.
British star Carey Mulligan will receive this year's Cinemark Vanguard Award for her role in Promising Young Woman. part comedy, part revenge movie, with a strong message for young women and those men who may choose to prey on them. Roger, who's had the good fortune to see Mulligan on the stage in London playing Chekhov, also praises her for her strong support of women directors breaking into the industry. Roger also took us through the Big Dipper anxieties he and his planners endured during official orders for lockdown, countermanded then by announcements of relaxation for crowded events.
There were Don Quixote-like dreams of building out movie theaters and parks outdoor. And then as we got closer and closer to making a final decision, which was in November, we realized that dream of doing outdoor movie theaters and parks was not feasible and smart or safe. And I think we all cried for 24 hours. We just thought we were going to go just online. And then 24 hours later, this other quixotic dream of doing drive-ins at City College materialized. We're excited about it. I mean, you know the film Brigadoon. Every 100 years, this beautiful village appears. Let's hope that this setup that we're doing this year is only going to be every 100 years.
Mickey Dusevich explained the reduction in the number of films in the festival this year as a result of enforced changes in production schedules, courtesy of the COVID pandemic.
We weren't able to take our usual 130 feature films. We wanted to focus on, obviously, our competition sections, but I also didn't want to lose all those other little sections that we have above and beyond of sports films. And we made a decision to put them throughout our competition section. Above and beyond, we made sure there's a surf film in competition and a film about basketball, Alaska Nets. Our nature section, we couldn't have it, but I wanted to make sure like Conservation Game came in because it's such a strong film about big cats and what they're trying to do and saving those cats, which that documentary is very eye-opening.
He and the rest of the team wanted to make sure that even with fewer films screened, pretty well every section the public has come to expect would be included. Audrey Arne gave a ringing endorsement to a documentary recording the efforts of an Idaho couple setting off in their camper, collecting signatures from regular citizens to demand an expansion of Medicaid.
It's a documentary, Reclaim Idaho, that's the name of the film, and of this movement. The movement was started by this couple that saw how thousands of people were going to lose access to Medicaid. And it's such a red state. Some of these issues that really are ultimately bipartisan, there's one narrative. What I love about the film is that it's normal people standing up and going out there, and their efforts were successful. They were able to pass Medicare expansion.
As always, we're grateful to Roger, Mickey, and Audrey for finding the time to talk to us and discuss the major events and trends of this year's festival. And if you're able to get down to City College for some of the drive-ins and access of other movies on your home screens, you will be richly rewarded.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Contributor Harry Lawton reports on the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which is going on now through Saturday, April 10th.
Robin Hauser is a documentary filmmaker who makes films about female empowerment, an expression she prefers to feminist or feminism. Her last film was called Bias, and that's a theme very evident in her latest work, Savvy, showing at the Santa Barbara Film Festival online to April the 10th.
Yeah, I'd like to call it female empowerment because to some, feminism still has sort of negative connotations, certainly not to me and hopefully not to you, but to some it's sort of people react a little bit, it's got a little bit of an edge to it. So I like to say female empowerment and education, and again, not exclusively to women.
Her previous film, Bias, dealt with implicit bias that works against women in the workforce, as well as in the world of finance.
Bias was really about unconscious bias, and you're looking at how, particularly gender and racial bias, of course, there are hundreds of biases out there, but for the purpose of bias documentary, I focused on gender and racial bias and the microaggressions, right? But unconscious bias. And absolutely, when you think about women and money, I think pretty solid reason why women tend to abdicate major financial decisions to somebody else, whether that's their husband, their partner, their just somebody else in their lives, is partly based on these stereotypes that are, you know, about gender differences, that women aren't as good at math, that finance is a man's territory, and it really shouldn't be so.
How does such bias arise, and are there simple answers?
I don't think there's a simple answer. In fact, if there were, I probably wouldn't have enough material to make a documentary film about
good
this.
Good point.
But I do think that part of it is societal messaging. Women also deal with so much else. We take care of our children and the household, and many of us have jobs on the side of all that. So when it comes to dealing with money, sometimes it's the easiest to just let somebody else handle it. But here's why this is so important. Because even if you're in a really good relationship with somebody, even if you're, you know, independent, but you're in a great marriage, if you don't know about your money, or if you're not savvy about your money situation, you could be in a horrible place if you suddenly became widowed, if you became divorced, or if some sort of an emergency or crisis like COVID and you lost your job and you didn't have, say, emergency savings. But not knowing how much money you have, whether you have money in savings, who holds your mortgage, whether you have insurance, all of these things are so important.
What about basic financial education? Is this taught in schools?
Yeah, only seven states in the United States, only seven have standalone financial courses in high school. So this is something that has essentially been wiped out of the school curriculum. And some would argue that even if it were taught in school, personal finance, if it's not relevant to somebody at that age, if you're teaching a 12-year-old about compounding interest, it's probably not going to really stick. But age-appropriate education about money is so important, and it should start early. Dr. Brad Klontz talks about money scripts. We inherit these thoughts about money from our parents. So if our parents are constantly stressed about money, or if they're constantly fighting about money, then money to us becomes something that's taboo or something that's negative. And of course, then you want to sort of shy away from it or leave it to somebody else. We also tend to look at ourselves as, yeah, our future selves are perfect. We always think, oh, well, when I'm 30, I'll have it together. Or when I'm 40, I'll start saving, I'll start investing. And so because we look at our future selves as being more perfect than we are now, we don't spend a lot of time, financing that future. We don't, or taking care of. Whereas those people that are savvy with, say, investing in savings knows that the time to start saving is now. And I think you're right. The education needs to come from our parents, from school. But in many cases, if a kid, a teenager, does learn it in school, they actually then are able to go home and teach their parents.
Over half of American women are unprepared for financial independence. But are younger women, millennials, better prepared than their mothers?
Harry, that is one of the facts that was most shocking to me when I began to dig into this subject. I think we'd all agree that our grandmothers, perhaps, if she were typical, probably left money to her husband. And same thing, perhaps, with our parents. But what's especially shocking is that this is not a trend that's getting better. There's a higher percentage of millennial women than any other generation that is abdicating financial decisions to the men in their lives. And, you know, why is that? That's a problem.
There are also the questions of mortgages and pensions.
So what happens then is they suddenly seek a financial advisor when they're going through trauma. They're going through the death of a husband, or they're going through suddenly being divorced, or they're going through a financial crisis. And that, of course, we know is the worst time to have to suddenly, on top of the grief you're going through, or, you know, to have to be worrying about money. So understanding and educating. And by the way, it's okay if you in your marriage, in your partnership, decide that your partner is better at handling long-term investing, then that's okay. As long as you know where the money's going, how much money is going into it, what type of debt you have, what type of cash reserves you have, who holds the mortgage on your house. You just need to be aware of these things.
There's also a problem with credit cards without advice or instruction.
If you don't have a credit card, it's hard to establish credit. Yeah. Therefore, we're all incentivized, and we incentivize our college kids to start their own credit by getting a credit card. But whoever teaches you, certainly not the banks, who reads the fine print? Does anybody actually sit down and teach you that paying the minimum every month is going to get you in a lot of debt? A savvy documentary, we have a story about a young woman who's first generation American. She's on a full ride scholarship to an Ivy League school. She walks out of class one day and there's a tent set up giving away free pizza and free t-shirts. All you have to do is sign up for a credit card. And she thought, well, certainly I don't qualify. Neither of my parents even have, you know, they're immigrants from Dominican Republic. They don't have a credit card. No, no, absolutely. Sign here. Nobody ever taught her how to handle the credit card. And so, you know, the bank didn't for certain. So she ended up with over $20,000 in credit card debt as a college student. And it took her a long time to pay that off. Those are types of things that I really believe institutions should be teaching.
Robin also introduces us to a couple of the women financial advisors who've made it their job and vocation to teach women about financial pitfalls to avoid.
Christelle Turkowitz is a woman who is in our film who helps other women who are going through divorce.
I see.
She is a financial manager herself, and she tells a pretty compelling story about how, even though she had been in the business for 20 years as a wealth manager, when she went through divorce, she made classic mistakes. She left money on the table. She kept the family house, which is not an equal asset to, say, the stock portfolio. Christelle tells some great stories. And in Savvy Documentary, we see her meeting with a young woman who's going through divorce and helping to coach her along financially so that she, this young woman, understands how she's going to be able to survive and what things she should negotiate during her divorce. There's also Rachel Robasciotti, who runs a company called Adesina Capital. She reaches out to primarily women and non-binary individuals who want to invest with sort of social impact in mind. She noticed a growing trend of women and queer people, as she says, who wanted to feel good about the investments they're making, and they wanted to make sure that their money was going to some sort of environmental or social good, ESG.
Good.
Rachel is a wonderfully brilliant woman who has found her own niche to help people understand and sort of to demystify this whole investment world.
Finally, Robin does include some humor in the film. Always a good idea to humanize the seriousness of a topic. And it's an important movie with an always timely message. It can be seen on demand until the 10th. For more detailed information, go to the festival website, sbiff.org. This is Harry Lawton reporting.
The name of Robin Hauser's film is Savvy. KCSB's Harry Lawton reports from Santa Barbara through a partnership with KCBX. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.